Part 4. The Way to Radico. Chapter 1. In the cool dawn of the equinox, the statue of St. Christopher of the Wayfarers stood distinct over Old Bridge, over the river and the light mist on the surface of the water. A purity of light, a stillness of air and sky, effaced the boundaries between living and inanimate. The stone saint seemed to have paused there to look eastward, smiling and unseeing. There were no clouds. The sun rose over dark hills and sent its first rays straight into the eyes of the two horsemen riding over Old Bridge, dazzling them, making them squint and smile. The bridge was crossed. The riders entered the shadow of a long street. Eight hooves clattered with a clipped, brisk noise on the cobbles of the Trasfuive between files of sleeping houses. One rider turned in the saddle to see the new light on the towers of the cathedral behind them across the river. Look there, Amadei. The light. Estenska did not turn. He looked ahead, down the long, straight street, and said, "Come on. This horse wants to run." The fretting bay, then the brown mare, broke into a trot. They were spirited, their riders good horsemen, a handsome sight as they rode from the city towards the first sunrise of the year's fall. By 8 o'clock, from the climbing streets of grass, Itali could look back and see all Krasnoye, lying along its sunlit river, beautiful and smoky in the morning. Then, leaving the little town, they crossed the crown of the ridge and lost the valley, its river and city, behind them on their way. Down all day among the hills, a faint warm wind in their faces bearing the smells of earth, hay, wood smoke. At dusk, a village ahead, in the next fold of the hills, trees and thatched roofs and chimney smoke, offering rest, firelight after the long day's ride. "There'll be an inn," Itali said. He began to sing, "Red are the berries on the autumn bough," and his mare pricked her ears and stepped along towards hay and dinner. Dusk was heavy under old trees as they rode up into the village, and the sign of the Golden Lion creaked in the evening breeze. "What a good place," Itali said, dismounting. There were no other travellers at the inn. They were served good beer before the fire, and a big old hen roasted crisp. They left nothing of her but bones. Then Itali stretched out his legs and, for the ritual and completeness of the thing, lighted the clay pipe provided by the host of the Golden Lion. "Never saw you smoke before," said his friend. "Never smoke," said Itali. "How do you keep the damn thing going?" Estenska went on watching him. Since Itali, extended in profound comfort and puffing hard on the pipe, was oblivious. "I'm glad we're traveling together," he said. "Of course." Estenska smiled and turned his gaze back to the fire. "It's good to get out of the city. You must take the mare tomorrow. She has a lovely gait. How long since I rode a horse, let alone a good one? This is a holiday, more than a holiday. Escape." Itali waved the pipe, which had gone out. "I was full up, Amadei. Absolutely full up. Now I'm empty again. At last. Air, sunlight, silence, space." Estenska got up and went to the door of the inn room, which gave directly on the village street, without threshold between the hard earth outside and the hard earth of the inn floor. The darkness under the wide-armed oaks was cool and soft. Wind stirred now and then. The sign creaked. In the black foliage, a few stars shone fitfully and eclipsed the restless leaves. "Is it so easy," he said, "after so long that Italy, befogged with exercise, fresh air, beer, and well-being, was not sure what he was talking about?" You set out to make yourself, to make the world. All the things you must do and see and learn and be, you must go through it all. But leave home, come to the city, travel, miss nothing, experience it all. You make yourself. You fill the world with yourself and your purposes, your ambitions, your desires, until there's no room left, no room to turn round. There is here, Itali put in. I told you, I'm as empty as that beer jug. Air, sunlight, silence, space. That won't last. It will. It's we who don't last. Estenska leaned against the doorway, gazing out into the country darkness. "Now that I know that I can't choose," he said, "now that I've finally learned that there are no choices, that I can't make my way and never could, that it was all conceit and deceit and waste, now that I've given up trying to make my way, I can't find it. I can't hear the voice. I'm lost. I went too far, and there's no way home." In later years, when Itali heard his friend's name spoken, what came to him always was this moment, the big, dirt-floored room, the candle and beer jug on an oaken table, the fire, the stir of autumn wind in dark branches, the silence that underlay and surrounded and closed over Estenska's voice, so that the last word, softly spoken, seemed to fail and die away in the immense, unheeding quiet. "But by going back to Esten..." Itali began and stopped, knowing his words were stupid, but wanting to change Estenska's mood. He'd been happy that day, and was sorry to let happiness go. "That's not my home. It's too late. One road goes east, another west, but there's no destination unless you're given it. Given it. You don't choose it. You only accept it when it's offered, if it's offered. Why am I going to Esten, then? I don't know." He spoke harshly, glancing around at Itali with a vindictive stare. But Itali had learned long ago that Estenska's anger was never for him. "It always makes a difference where you are," he said. "Come back and sit down. We just got free. No point worrying about where we're going yet." Estenska obeyed him. He came back to the table and sat down, putting his elbows on the table and his head between his hands, ruffling up his coarse reddish hair. "All I do is think about myself and talk about myself," he said miserably. "It's a worthwhile subject, but I wish I... if it hadn't been for you, this last year..." They were both embarrassed, and there was a short silence between them. "That dream of yours, are you chasing it?" Estenska shook his head. "Was Esten a part of it?" "I don't know. I only know that since it, I've had to get out of Krasnoy, get away." "You knew that the first time we talked together, at my place, and ate that cheese 2 years ago. And I was still living with Rosalie then, right in the depths of it. God. What a fool." Itali investigated the beer jug again, found what he expected, nothing, and got up, stretching his arms. "I'll be stiff tomorrow morning. I'm out of condition for riding. Look here, Itali. While we're talking..." "Aye? While we're talking?" Itali looked down at him, grave. What about Luisa Palodesca? So I asked myself. What's gone wrong? I don't know. I don't understand what it is she wants. You never will. What is it you want? Itali put his hands against the heavy mantelpiece, looking down into the fire. To sleep with her. Is that what she wants? I thought it was. But now she wants more than that. No. Less. Itali spoke very slowly, trying to say what he did not know how to say. I don't understand it. We're in love, but we don't get on. We hurt each other a good deal. I don't understand why. I don't understand. I don't understand, said the straw in the fire. In love. Love is an invention of the poets, Itali. Believe me, I should know. It's a lie. It's the worst of all the lies. A word without meaning. Not a rock, but a whirlpool. The emptiness that sucks down the soul. There must be... Oh, well, I don't much want to talk about it. I'm running away for a while, maybe. I'll see things clearer afterwards. You wouldn't look back when we left Krasnoy. You were right. Estenska nodded. But 24 hours later, after their night at the Golden Lion, and a day's ride through pleasant, quiet country, when they were lying on a great straw mound in a barn loft, each wrapped in a horse blanket lent them by the hospitable farmer, all the smells of barn and stable strong in their nostrils, and all the stars brilliant outside the great loading window of the loft, he returned to the subject. Luisa is trying to make the world, he said, the way I did. And she'll destroy it, the way I did. Don't let her pull you off course, Itali. I don't know what my course is. I thought I did. I don't know what's right, what I ought to do. I don't like this. She calls it freedom, an affair, a love affair, secrecy, nothing ever to count on. That is her freedom. She's no fool. If she married you, then you'd be free, and she'd be the one trapped. Love's the game where there are only losers. Listen, Itali, I won't bring this up again. It's none of my business, I know that. I've known Luisa for years. I might have fallen in love with her if I hadn't met the other one first. She likes me. She tries to take and choose. She sees you, and she can't let you be. If she can't own you, she will destroy you. You do not know, I hope you never know, the envy that eats her when she looks at you. But I know it. Look out for her. Look out for me. We will destroy you if we can, Itali. His tone was cold and playful. But you can't, Itali said. Slowly, not playfully. Go alone, Estenska whispered. Go alone. The stars shone splendid in the great square of the window, Vega overhead. The lion, like a mower's sickle, left lying in the white wheat. The swan on the river of stars. And in the southwest, Scorpio, huge among lesser constellations, cold above the warm earth night. The horses and cattle in the stalls beneath snorted, shifted, slept their queer waking sleep. A few late crickets trilled. No longer alarmed by human voices, Itali slept, and waking before dawn, opened his eyes to colourless gulfs of space, where, fading, Orion stood, hunter and warrior of the winter sky. They came that day to Sorg, a little city on the confluence of the rivers Sorg and Ras. And following the Ras a few miles in late afternoon, left the Fralana province and entered the Polana. As if waiting for them there, the east wind rose after sunset, carrying the chill of great spaces crossed, long plains and empty hills. They stayed at a village inn, wakened often from sleep by the bleating of hundreds of sheep penned in fields behind the inn, the clanking of sheep bells, the carousing of the drovers in the common room beneath. The next day was cool. A fine fog was dissolved through the sky, so that in the pale glare reflected from horizon to horizon, the sun looked small and wan. As they went east and south, the wind blew in their faces. The land grew poorer as they rode. Ploughlands yielded to grasslands rolling to an interminable distance. They rode all day alone between earth and sky, with few trees or streams or houses or men to keep them company in the middle space. The road mounted, taking a whole day to rise 1,000 feet. As they neared Eston, the slopes became steeper, the rare farms poorer, crouched with their sheep pens under the western side of a hill in the lee of the endless wind. They came to the village of Colei in the late afternoon and pushed on 4 more miles to Eston, arriving after night had fallen. All Itali saw of the house then was its lights hidden among trees at the foot of a hill whose high, smooth curve blocked out the east wind and the eastern stars. All round were dark hills in starlight. No light to be seen but the stars, and the one house lonely as a ship in mid-sea. After a brief supper with Estenska's brother and sister-in-law, the travellers went off to bed. Itali was given a room at the southeast corner, high, sparsely furnished, clean as bone. All the house was like that. The house, the room, smelled of the country. It was utterly silent. Waking late, he opened his eyes to a flood of white sunlight. In the yard below his window, a stable boy was singing as he curried a stamping, snorting horse. Itali had never heard the tune, and the dialect was hard for him to follow. In Rakava, beneath the high walls, I left my love forever. I came to live among the barren hills where runs no river. The archaic turns, the high, harsh, fluent voice pouring over trills and catches as a shallow stream pours over rocks. It was all part of the stirring, bright, windy morning, and Itali got up ready for whatever came next. He took breakfast with Amadei in the long dining room. Ladislas Estenska was on the fields, as his wife said, at work. She sat with them, though she had got up long before, when her husband did. She was quiet, dark, barely 18. She'd been married 5 months. Her manner was more that of a girl at home than a woman head of her household, and she was evidently in awe of her brother-in-law. With Itali, she got on at once, and he said to his friend as they climbed the hill above the house, "I like her, your little sister." Ladislas is a man of sense and taste. They don't come like that in the city. I knew a girl like her at Malafrena. What became of her, the girl at Malafrena? Well, they sent her to convent school in Aesna. Married a rich widower. Should never have let her leave the country. Town spoils them. My word. What a view. Beneath them now, the house and stables huddled at the head of the vale, at the edge of a sparse, straggling wood. All round the barren crest where they stood stretched pale, rounded hills. Even in the farthest distance, hardly blued by the dry, pure sunlit air. The grass on them was short as stubble after mowing. Here and there, the flocks, ragged grey like patches of dandelion in seed, were scattered on the slopes. Sheep bells made a faint, sparse music over all the great landscape. Northward, beyond the end of the woods, on a scarped and wrinkled summit higher than the other hills, something stood at the edge of a site, a wall, or tower. "What's that, Amadei?" Estenska turned. The wind and light made him squint. His hard, thin face looked as if it was made of the same stuff as the high, pale, arid land. "That tower? Radiko, it's called. Castle? Blown up in the war of the three kings. Not much of it left. Which king did they back?" Estenska laughed. "The pretender. People here are never on the winning side." When they came down from the hilltop, the cessation of the wind was a relief, as was the presence of things close at hand, walls and trees, giving shelter from the pale distances. They met Ladislas coming into the yard, and with him went to the stables to look at the two horses Amadei had bought in Krasnoy. Admiring the brown mare, he stroked her neck and said, "You always had an eye for horses, Amadei." And it was plain that he was glad the younger brother had come home, that he loved him, admired him, and was afraid of him. In the afternoon, they rode out to show Itali the estate. The elder brother talked farming with him. The younger was mostly silent. Sheep were raised in the Montena, but Itali had had little to do with them and had never seen flocks or pasturage on anything like this scale. He was impressed, fascinated, asked Ladislas endless questions, to which the answers became increasingly technical and complete, as Ladislas discovered that he was talking to a man who had worked on the fields, and began to forget that the guest was a literary fellow from the city. They reined in beside one of the deep, stone-mounted wells, and dismounted to look at it, and remounted, but neglected to ride on, discussing intently and with passion the principal problem of farming in the Polana, and its principal difference from farming in the Montena, the lack of surface water. Amadei sat silent, patient on a patient old horse from the stable of the farm, gazing at the hills. As he rode back to the house with Itali, he said, "It's queer coming back, like coming to a foreign country. Utterly foreign, and finding one speaks the language perfectly." That night after supper, they sat talking by the fire. Ladislas' wife began to gather courage, and when Amadei said something about his book now in press, she asked in her soft voice, "Have you brought it with you?" "Only my rough copy. Rochoy has it. It'll come out early in 28. "You're the cause of our meeting, Amadei," his brother said. "Jivana wanted to see what Estenska's brother looked like." "I'm Estenska's brother. I'm glad to have been of use. It's the first time I've heard of my reputation doing any good to anyone." "He is weary of fame," Itali said. "Soon he will get weary of being weary, I hope. He always runs his books down, too. The better they are, the more he reviles them. The next one may really be quite fair, going by that indication." "Is it a novel?" asked Jivana. "What will it be called? Can you say what it's about?" It's called Jivan Fogan, and it's about him, Amadei replied, with an evident effort not to intimidate her. Very gloomy. It didn't really come off. See, said Itali, no one has seen it. We've all been told how very poor it is. It's not poor, Amadei said. I wouldn't publish it if it were. Ladislas grinned. Either he liked to see his brother teased a bit, or liked to see him fire up. It's merely mediocre, Itali said. It's not what it should have been, that's all. It's not as good as Karante's book. I wish it was. The young man, Livie? Jivana asked, timorous, her eyes very large and dark, her hands tensely clasped in her lap. There's young Livie, you know, in person, Amadei said, indicating Itali, who at once got hot in his turn. Oh, rot, Amadei! Jivan Karante was writing that book before he ever met me. Besides, there's absolutely nothing in common. Sorde, too, is weary of fame. Sorde's dignity is hurt, and he can't think of anything clever to say, said Itali. Is that a piano hidden over there? It was a delicate and cranky old harpsichord. And Jivana played for them, formal little salon pieces of the last century. Her husband stood protectively near her while she played, turning the pages of the music. They sang together, a Scottish love song, so the yellowed book said, a yearning tune in which their voices blended with a reticent clarity. They had sung it before, alone in the lonely house, for their own pleasure. Itali, watching them, thought, but this is how it should be. How have they found it so simply? And for a minute, there in the peaceful room, by the fire, listening to that music, it seemed to him that life was an infinitely simple thing, if anyone looked at it clearly, without fear. That if one were thirsty, one need only look to see close by, however dry the land, the deep well, the well of clean water. But it wasn't his spring, it wasn't his land. He stayed a week at Eston. He went about the farm with Ladislas, went shooting with Amadei in the sparse forests, talked with the brothers and Jivana in the evenings. He felt half at home, because it was the country, a farm, and half strange, a city visitor among these hard-working people, no part of the spare, silent current of their life. Amadei was increasingly silent, speaking curtly and sometimes at random out of some inner preoccupation. On his last day there, Itali suggested they ride over to the ruined tower, Radico. No, Amadei said. Then, becoming aware of the uncouthness of his refusal, he scowled. Nothing there, he said. I'd rather... I want to go there alone. I'm sorry. His face was angry, obdurate, suffering. Everything Itali thought came hard to him. He could take nothing lightly in life. Even Itali's admiring, undemanding friendship caused him pain. All love hurt him. The ropes burn my hands, said the ferryman on the icy river in his first book. Stay a while longer, he said, late that last night. Ladislas and Jivana had gone to bed, leaving them talking by the fire. I promised to meet Isaber. It's a foul city, Rakava, Amadei said, brooding, gazing into the fire. You shouldn't go there. Only Easterners can understand the East. Then come with me. Help me with these articles. Amadei merely shook his head. Next day at noon, beside the little dusty coach that would take Itale to Rakava, he said, "When you see Caronte this winter, tell him..." He paused for a long time, shrugged, looked off down the dusty, straggling street of the village. "It doesn't matter," he said. The driver was up on his box. It was time for Itale to mount up beside him. "Don't stay here too long, Amadei. Come back to your friends," he said, putting out his hand to touch his friend's arm, to embrace him, if Amadei would. Amadei pulled away from him, saying, "All right, goodbye. Have a good trip." And without looking at him, turned and went off. Itale stood a moment, nonplussed, then swung himself up on the high wheel and took his place. The coach set off with a jangle and commotion of harness and wheels and shouting. Itale looked back through the dust thrown up by the horse's hooves and saw his friend, already mounted on the bay horse, riding off on the road to Eston. Behind him, the mare, her saddle empty, followed quietly.